This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Two recent homicides of small children in Vermont have sparked anger at the Department for Children and Families, and a legislative review of the department's policies is now underway. In February, two-year-old Desiree Sheldon of Poultney was brought to a hospital with signs of head trauma. She died 2 days later, and her stepfather has been arrested for her murder. Sheldon had been in DCF custody in the past, but had been reunited with her mother, and some family members say she never should have been returned to her mother's care. Last week, the April death of 15-month-old Peyton Girard of Winooski was ruled a homicide as well. In that situation, a DCF caseworker had been at the house of the toddler just an hour before he was brought to the hospital. The caseworker had noticed bruising on the child's neck but had not removed the child from the home. The parents of Peyton Girard have not been charged in his death, but were jailed on unrelated charges. These two cases have put a spotlight on the Department for Children and Families. Among other investigations, a Senate panel will be reviewing DCF policy. Senator Peg Flory is on that committee.
I think it's a systemic problem. Is there proper training? What are the job descriptions? Is there appropriate follow-through? If there isn't, is it a manpower problem? Is it a protocol problem? What is the problem?
Later on in the program, we're going to hear from one of the co-chairs of that panel that Senator Flory is on. But we're going to talk now with the commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, Dave Iacovone. Commissioner Iacovone cannot speak about the specifics of either case that I just mentioned because they're under investigation and because there are also confidentiality rules in discussing children. But we are going to talk with him about the department policies and goals and systemic concerns these cases have brought to light. Listeners, if you have questions about how DCF operates, what the responsibilities of caseworkers are in volatile and difficult family situations, or suggestions for improving a complicated process, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Commissioner Iacovone, welcome back to the program.
Hello.
Hi. So tell me first a little bit, just so we have a sense, how cases are investigated by DCF when either a school official or a medical person or a concerned citizen thinks there may be abuse or neglect going on in a home.
Sure. So folks will call us and share their concerns. An intake worker will collect the information, gather the information, whether it be a medical professional, school, or a neighbor for that matter, law enforcement and such, and record the information and make a determination whether an investigation should be done. So we receive approximately, we will this year, we're on track to receive over 17,000 such calls. 5 or 6 years ago, I think that number was closer to 12,000. And we will actively review about 5,000 of those cases. Some do not rise to the level where they warrant an investigation or an assessment, but many do.
17,000 calls is what you said you're on target for this year. And as you said, you review about 5,000 of those. 5,000 go further. When you say that this has risen over the past several years, is that, do you think, because there's more abuse and neglect going on in Vermont or more reporting of it?
I think it's probably both. I mean, the number of children in custody has plateaued, but the number of the awareness and the obligation and the education that people have to be reporters certainly has increased. But I think what's driving the numbers, we're facing an epidemic of opiates and drug abuse, and kids sadly are the victim. And these are drugs that damage the brain to the point that you would do harm to that which you love the most, your children. So the landscape, in my view, is shifting and making this work much more complex.
Of the calls that are sent to your department but don't rise to the level of investigation, why not? Are those spurious calls? I mean, if only 5,000 are actually investigated and you're going to get 17,000 calls, that means the majority of them are not investigated. So why not?
Well, in some cases, we may receive multiple calls on the same case. In many cases, there's just insufficient information. I saw somebody's car parked in the back of over in front of Big Lots, and I thought they were shaking their finger and hollering at their child to the point, and I'm concerned, and there may not be any name, license plate. That there's just insufficient information to act on cases. That happens a lot in situations, and whether it's abuse or neglect.
So if you've got all of these calls, what then is the authority of a caseworker in your department or somebody who works in your department to remove a child from a situation?
Well, if a caseworker came into your house, that caseworker does not, on his or her own, have the authority to remove your child. If the caseworker found that a child was in danger and had been abused and neglected, the caseworker can contact the court, does contact the court. They're available on a 24/7 basis and seeks permission to act. Caseworker also might call the police to come, and the police do have that authority. Or, depending on the nature of the case and the call and such, caseworker might be accompanied by a police officer who has that authority. But the caseworkers do not, on their own, cannot go into your house and remove your child.
How often does removal happen in Vermont?
I don't have the exact numbers. When we would instantly, you mean, go into a house and make that call to the court? I don't have that exact number in front of me.
But if not instantly, then how many children are generally under the custody of DCF?
Well, as we speak, we have approximately 1,000 children who are in our custody at this time. There's turnover. Some 700 children will go home this year, and new children will come in behind them. So there's a significant volume. The number was, though, approximately 1,500 five or six years ago. I think it was 2009. To be more precise, where there were roughly 1,500 children in custody. And what we've done is tried to, where a family doesn't need to lose their child, but there need to be services for that family, we will do what's called an open case, where we're involved, but we're not taking the child, and we're going to work with a family. It could lead to that, but that's another intervention. Children should not have to leave their moms and dads to get the services that they need. Surely if they're being abused or neglected, they do. But that's not always the level that these things rise to.
If they're not being abused or neglected, what are the problems?
Well, there may be such that, it's a combination. I've said this before, and I'll try to be quick. For some families, sadly, they live in a toxic stew of stresses. There's poverty in the home. There may be addictions in the home, drug abuse in the home, not to the point where they're hurting their children. Sadly, there may be no employment, no transportation, a myriad of different factors that cause stress and that can put children at risk of maltreatment. And our job is to try to abate that and help families dial back on those stressors. Some families, many, have the resiliency to cope with these pressures, but sadly, many do not.
So do you see the goal of the Department for Children and Families as protecting a child, making sure the child has the very best childhood he or she can? Or is your goal more about helping families figure things out and be functional families? Because there can be a distinction.
There is a distinction, but to me it's a dual goal of obviously protecting children and safety when that needs to happen. Obviously that's paramount. But just as important, Jane, and this is critical, is to help strengthen families, to have child care centers that are at high quality, and the governor's been a strong advocate of this, as has Doug Racine, to increase the quality opportunities for children, to have WIC clinics that do more than just nutrition but are a second set of eyes on families. To me, making sure kids succeed is critical. because if we can get kids off to a strong start and help strengthen parenting, you know, I've said before, parenting is probably the greatest obligation ever bestowed on any of us for which we're the least prepared. If we can do those things and build those assets, especially among young children, the likelihood that kids and their families will be successful is dramatically improved. That's a critical goal of the department. It's more than just removing children from harm's way, though that is critical. It's about making sure kids don't get into harm's way in the first place.
But is that then a judgment call? I mean, we're not speaking about specific cases today because you can't, because they're under investigation. But is it a judgment call from the people who work in your department as to whether or not a family is capable of taking adequate care of a child that sometimes you get wrong?
Well, it is a judgment call, and there's no way to ultimately control human behavior. But we do have structured assessment tools that we use when we try to make these decisions. Nobody gets them right all the time. I mean, that would be disingenuous for me to suggest otherwise. The nature of the work is critical, and it's so important. But there's a distinction here. We usually can tell when a family is dealing with those stresses that I talked about, but the children look well, and we can discern that difference from when, oh my gosh, this child's got bruises, it's been hurt in some different way. We can act on that. There is a distinction. We don't get it right all the time, though I think we do most of the time. You know, so often we don't hear about the successes of DCF because it's hard. Who wants to step forward and say, you know, I am ashamed. I abused my child when I was in a different place, when I was on drugs and I couldn't control myself. But it's 5 years later and I've succeeded and I'm a successful mom. People don't like to come forward and share those stories. We understand that. We often hear from the cases where people are disgruntled and unhappy, but not from the successes.
We're talking today with the Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families in Vermont, David Iacovone. And listeners, if you have questions for him about the policies of the department, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Tom, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I've got a couple questions kind of related to how DCF interacts with all these other parties that have been involved with these kids. It's a twofold question. Basically, I guess I want to understand better how important is information that DCF gets from medical professionals when there's evidence of physical injury. And I'm thinking about cases like the one in Winooski. And the second question is when kids are placed by a judge into DCF custody, like they were with this child in the southern part of the state, how common is it for the judge or other people involved in the court process to be involved in the decision to return the kid home? I'll be glad to. I'm curious to hear about that.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the questions. Commissioner Iacovone, two questions there.
Well, obviously, the medical information is so critical. That drives us. You know, if the medical folks see things and can share that with us, the more details they have, the more it's accurate, is essential to our ability to do the job. As to the role of the judges, you know, as I say, no one comes into custody unless they go through the court process, and no one leaves custody unless they go through the court process, and the judge is the decider. He or she gets to listen to a lot of different people render their opinions, lawyers for the child, for the parents, guardian ad litem, social workers, state's attorneys, but the judge plays a very critical role.
And Tom, we're also going to be looking more deeply into that question of unification and when a child should go back to his or her family, a biological family, a little bit later in the program. But listeners, again, if you have questions for Commissioner Iacovone about the Department for Children and Families, how it works, why there is a goal of reunification for family members, you can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're speaking with the Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families about how DCF investigates suspected cases of child abuse and neglect and what the goals of the department are in terms of family reunification and child safety. Listeners, if you have questions for Commissioner Iacovone, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, since the death of Desiree Sheldon, the toddler in Poultney, a committee was formed in the legislature to look at the Department for Children and Families, how it operates, and whether or not there may need to be legislative changes. Senator Dick Sears is co-chair of the Legislative Committee on Child Protection, and he joins us now. Senator Sears, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here, Jane.
So what exactly is it that your committee is charged with doing?
Well, it's just to look into now the two deaths of the young children and to try to determine what the best way to move forward would be. I think it's very similar to the following the Brooke Bennett murder. The legislature formed a special committee. We went out, we held public hearings, we heard from the public, we built support for various proposals and went forward with them, which resulted in changes to Vermont's response to child sexual abuse. And I'm hopeful that we'll get a similar response from the public make some changes in the way Vermont responds to child physical abuse and child neglect.
You will be holding hearings for the public.
We're going to actually start out pretty aggressively. We're going to hold 9 public hearings around the state starting June 3rd, June 5th, and June 10th. And people can find out where those hearings will be held at the legislative website.
When you say you think that this will result in changes in how Vermont investigates suspected cases of child abuse and neglect, does that mean that you think that because there were these two toddler deaths that there automatically need to be changes? Does that suggest that changes have to be made?
Well, I think it suggests that we need to at least review the policies and procedures that we're currently using. It's not just DCF, the courts, the police, everyone's involved in these types of cases. And I think that they lead us to ask questions about whether or not we've gone too far with reunification of the family, and rather than looking at what are the best interests of the child. Now, I know, you know, I've been around long enough, worked in the field. I worked with SRS before there was a DCF. And I know that, you know, no matter which way you go, you're going to be criticized. It's either being too far one way or the other. But I think in some respects, we've lost sight of the best interest of the child.
Can you go a little bit deeper into that? What do you mean?
Well, I think that if you look at and talk with foster parents and school officials and others, as I have over the years, you'll find a lot of concern that we tend to put children in some positions that may not be safe, and that's the concern. Now, it's not just, again, I want to emphasize, it's not just a DCF decision. It's a court decision. It involves multiple layers, and there is some of the federal requirements, but I think we need to really begin to look at how far we've gone down this path, and other states are in the same boat.
Would you look into the possibility of requiring an ombudsman in Vermont for the Department for Children and Families, so that people who have questions about cases might be able to call somebody and have that person investigate?
Yeah, I think that the committee itself is willing to look at any number of measures. You know, among those is not to be open or closed. And when there's an investigation into a serious case like the deaths of these two children, should they be confidential? Should we be able to learn as much as we would if it had been a murder of a 25-year-old? Should it all be private? Some states have gone to an open investigation process. We'll be looking at different responses around the state. I've heard anecdotally that in some counties, it's almost automatic that there isn't reunification that they lean too heavily the other way to not reunify the family. So we need to understand whether or not Vermont has a uniform response or a response that varies by county to county.
Okay, well, we'll keep up with what is happening in your committee as you hold these hearings and as you make some recommendations. Senator Dick Sears is the co-chair of the Legislative Committee on Child Protection. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
We're also talking today with the Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, Dave Iacovone. While he can't talk about specific and ongoing cases, DCF Commissioner is answering questions about how the department operates. You can call with your questions 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Commissioner Iacovone, we have a lot of calls, and I want to make sure we get to many of them. But just briefly, Senator Sears said he thinks that in some cases we have gone too far on the side of reunification for families. And it is the stated goal of the Department for Children and Families to reunify families when possible so that the child can live with his or her biological parents or the family that he or she has grown up with. Do you agree? Do you think we've gone too far?
Well, it's not only the goal of the department to reunify where possible, but it's also the directive from the federal government. The senator raises good concerns, and we need to look at those. We need to dig deeply and try to analyze that fully. When I look at the data, though, recently, and I have so much data, but my recollection is slightly more than 50% of the children were reunified over a five-year period, and that's looking at young children, I think, under the age of two. So it's not the vast majority. It's not like we're saying 90% of all children are reunified. And if you look at the data, some years it might be 47%, other years 53%, et cetera. It moves around. That doesn't mean that it doesn't precisely answer the concerns that people raise, but it kind of supports my notion that I think there's a balance to this, but we definitely have to look at it more strongly. That's without doubt, and I welcome that. That's the kind of function we should do.
Is that something that you can look at independently of the legislative panel? Can you make changes without the legislature requiring them?
Oh, sure. I mean, we can, but those are practice changes. Again, the federal government says, you know, you should be reunifying. We provide data that we track all of that. But the question is, our practice and our policies and our work in the field and supported by training and education and working with families, we have the ability, with or without the legislature, to adjust that. Now, I guess the legislature could pass a law and say we're going to influence reunification in the following way. But I think what the senator is saying, he wants to examine that. I don't know if he's come to a conclusion.
We have a lot of listeners who have questions for you or thoughts on this, and I want to share an email with you first. Mike wrote in to say, the current commissioner has spent his career on the money side of DCF, not on child abuse and neglect or family services. I know this is a good man, Mike says, but shouldn't someone be there with some knowledge of what it is like to knock on someone's door and confront them with abuse or neglect?
I think that's a great question. And fortunately, yes, I have worked 38 years in human services. I worked in the field. I've had a caseload myself. I know the nature of the work and the stresses that families feel. But my deputy, Cindy Walcott, I think it's 33 years she's been doing this work. I'm surrounded and augmented by folks who are experts in the field. It's not that I'm green to this. I'm not an expert in child abuse. I'd be the first to mention that. I think I am an expert in health and human services, and the nature of this problem is bigger than knocking on a door and doing an investigation, which is critical. It's about systems and how those systems can be structured in such a way to support families, and that is in my wheelhouse.
There have been some calls for your resignation in light of Desiree Sheldon's death, your resignation, and the Secretary of Human Services, Doug Racine. Do you see any merit to those calls?
Well, I think it's our nature, and I'm only human myself, to whenever there's something horrible that happens, we want to ask who's to blame, who can we hold accountable and responsible. But I think many of us have learned before you act too soon, you want all the facts and all the evidence. And while a resignation may satisfy that natural need, you know, we're angry and we want to do something about it. It doesn't bring back the children and it doesn't change the system. So when you ask me a question, you're probably expecting me to say, oh, no, I shouldn't be fired, et cetera, or I shouldn't resign. And guess what I'm saying is I want to do whatever will improve the system. And attacking symptoms and not the root cause, in my mind, doesn't make much sense.
So I guess then people might say, okay, then what are you going to do to address the root problem? Because if that's what you're saying needs to be done and you're in the position to do it, what is it that you think you can do and will do?
I think there's a number of steps that we can take, you know, everything from a rigorous review of our policies and practices. And I know when you say that, well, there's a bureaucrat talking about policy and practices. They matter deeply in this kind of business. The governor has asked me, he said, Dave, I want your best recommendations on the solutions to this. And if you need more resources, I want to know that. So we're acting quickly in that regard. But what I want to try to stress, though, is I want less kids in harm's way. And that isn't idle rhetoric with me, Jane. I want to help strengthen families so kids do not get into this horrific situation. I want to break the trajectory that sadly too many of them are on for bad outcomes. If we don't invest there, you and I will be having conversations, or you'll be having it in the future with some other commissioner or a different legislator about why did we make a poor judgment call. So that's very important. But the meat and potatoes, are kids safe? Are we protecting them? That's critical also. There's a dual mission here, and both have to be done very well.
Let's go to Kara, who's calling in now from Rutland. Hi, Kara.
Yes, hi. We adopted our children through the foster care system, and I just wanted to talk about the need for services like he's talking about for the birth parents, because there's no doubt in my mind that the young 22-year-old that had to give up her three kids loves them, but she just, it wasn't good for the kids, and I cherish them every day, but I do wish that somewhere along the way, that hurt child who is their mother had gotten the help that she needed.
Kara, what do you think needs to be done to help that kind of person?
Well, in her case, there was definitely substance abuse issues, but there also was an ongoing cycle of poverty and abuse within her birth family. So, you know, at some point, could there have been an intervention that supported her both within the school system to be successful economically more than she had been, and also, you know, so that perhaps the substance abuse wouldn't have been an issue in the first place, but once it was, there just didn't seem to be any way of reaching her and really helping her break that abuse. And I know that's complicated, but when someone's into it, so I guess I take a step back further and figure out how she should not have gotten into it in the first place.
Kara, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate that. Commissioner Iacovone, you said earlier in the program that you're seeing perhaps a rise in child abuse and neglect cases because of the opiate problem that we have in Vermont and because of drug abuse. So do you see this as a problem that your department alone won't be able to solve until there is more of a problem-solving method for the opiate problem?
Well, that's definitely. I mean, the governor has made an aggressive attempt to put that issue on the front burner and to address it, but DCF cannot address it alone. I know we've done a lot of work around trauma and adverse childhood experiences, and sadly what that means for children when they become adults of much, much poorer health. But many folks are left to self-medicate and take drugs because they're dealing with trauma that's never been addressed before. So you're right. The problem is bigger than one department. The problem requires the whole agency and the whole state, that matter, to rethink how we address these issues.
Let's go to Cliff in Salisbury. Hi, Cliff. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. So, you know, I've been involved with the system over the years, and my children have been exposed to more of a mental abuse than a physical abuse. And over the past 14 years, my daughter now has gone to cutting herself, despite my requests for help to have that mental abuse stop. It seems as though that has been one category that has been very afraid to be delved into, perhaps. And maybe it's also possible because it's the mother who's the one who's doing that sort of manipulation and control. But if my daughter survives, I guess my point on top of this is she's also going to now end up in the system, maybe either doing inappropriate behaviors towards her children or maybe her spouse. I mean, there are long-term implications that I have been unable to help her with despite all the counseling and efforts that I've put forth.
Yeah, Cliff, I hear what you're saying, and, you know, you're really echoing there what Kara said about a need to be able to address parents and address people who are not yet parents in overcoming some of the challenges that they have so that they can be better parents. But speaking specifically to the question of psychological versus physical abuse, Commissioner Iacovone, what is the ability for DCF to intervene when the child abuse may not be physical, but it may be psychological?
First, my heart goes out to Cliff and all the families who are in that kind of a, oh my gosh, it's an indescribable situation. And we do make referrals to experts to help people. When people come into our net, so to speak, or when we're into our sphere of influence and we're working with them, we refer for help, whether it's psychological, physical, or otherwise. And it's so hard. There's no easy do the following three things sort of a cookbook approach. It takes multiple things, but clearly getting folks the mental health treatment that they need, like in situations like that, it is critical, and we work to make those referrals to make sure those services are provided.
So is psychological abuse something that rises to the same level, though, when it comes to intervention?
Well, absolutely, sure. The cause may be is multivariable, and there's a lot of different factors, but there are many, many different, many issues brought before us that are psychological in nature. Absolutely.
Let's go to Emmanuel calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Emmanuel.
I actually have a question regarding physical abuse at school. My son was victim of physical abuse at school by, many adults, but who didn't know what they were doing. And he ended up in a restraint for 2.5 hours where two people were sitting on him at that point, and they never called us. My son has ED, emotional disturbance, and he was in a very sad state when we brought him home. And I was wondering what things the DCF could do to prevent that sort of abuse.
Emmanuel, thanks for the question. And so, Commissioner Iacovone, when abuse is occurring in schools, not necessarily in a family situation, what's your role?
Well, schools are mandatory reporters, and they do report, and school, and we would investigate cases like that. Obviously, I think though what it speaks to is the challenge of behavioral interventions and what the best practice is. I know schools have made great progress in terms of working on behavioral disorders and challenges that they face. So we might, in working with a school, make a recommendation and tell them where they can get help. Many of them, though, know that and work with our designated agencies, our local community mental health agencies, programs like Success Beyond Six to get those services. But definitely we would look into something like that.
So that is a DCF kind of situation rather than a police or law enforcement situation?
Well, it depends on the facts that are involved. But if a school is trying to control behaviors, and oftentimes they're successful with that, and there's an injury resulting, it could lead to our department issuing a finding, or we might call in police if warranted. But there's no one size fits all answer to these things.
Commissioner Iacovone, these two deaths that we spoke about at the beginning of the program, two toddlers who've died in recent months in what appear to be cases of child abuse, they've raised a lot of questions and a lot of anger, and a lot of anger directed at your department and thoughts that maybe you need to change policies. So in your estimation, what are the questions that need to be answered And what's the timeline to get those answers?
Well, I think the questions around the cases are, and we have a very dedicated staff who work in the most challenging of environments, but did staff follow proper protocols? Was supervision provided as necessary? Were policies followed and adhered to? Documentation sufficient? All the kinds of things that would go into a case review. And then there's also a look at systems changes that need to be done. It might be larger than individual practice of social workers. So those things have to be done concurrently. We are doing those, and we're very, very busy conducting these kinds of reviews right now.
Let's go to Pete, who's calling in now from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I had a question for the commissioner. Is it true that stepfathers and boyfriends are more likely to commit physical child abuse than biological fathers? And if that's true, could this be one of the reasons for the increase in child abuse, since more children than ever are living in homes without their biological fathers?
Pete, thanks for the call. I don't know the statistics on whether or not children are living more now than in the previous couple of years in homes without biological fathers. But Commissioner Iacomone, do you have statistics on stepfathers and boyfriends versus biological fathers?
Well, I know 40% of childbirths in Vermont are out of wedlock, and that's a sea change from years ago. But I do not have any data immediately available to comment on whether stepfathers or boyfriends commit abuse more than biological fathers or parents.
We got a question from Tara, who says, are there any studies out there being done to compare successful child safety programs in other states nationwide? Is DCF looking at what other states are doing and their rates of successes? And are you aware of your own success statistics? So, yeah, how do you answer that, Commissioner Iacomone? Are there ways to compare?
Sure. We're reaching out right now to national experts. Cindy Walcott, our deputy commissioner, is reaching out for assistance on what different other states are doing, possible different practices, different training that we can use, et cetera. We do report to the federal government, and sometimes, though, sometimes it's apples and oranges, but there is benchmark data that we can review. Everything from, you know, the rate of home and monthly visitation of children, to permanency placement rates, to number of moves. Once a child's in foster care, how often do they move? How quickly do we reunify? How often do we? There's a myriad of different data that is available that are benchmark data. Yes. Yep.
We're talking right now with David Iacomone. He's the commissioner of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. We're talking about how the department investigates suspected cases of child abuse and neglect. Listeners, if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Commissioner Iacomone, stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. After the tragic deaths of two toddlers in Vermont in recent months, questions have been raised about how the Vermont Department for Children and Family operates, what its policies are, and whether or not there need to be changes. We are speaking today with the commissioner of that department, Dave Iacomone, and hearing from many of you. You can post your thoughts at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. And Chris is on the line with us from Bennington. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hello, Commissioner.
Hello.
I had read recently that the number of cases that a Vermont DCF caseworker carries is way above the national best practice standard. And I was one hoping if the Commissioner could verify that or rebut that. But if it is true, how do we as a state overcome that so that the workload is such that the child protective workers can do their job effectively?
Thanks for the call, Chris. Commissioner Iacomone.
Yes, Chris, you are accurate. The Vermont law says that the caseload ratio for social workers should be 1 to 12 families. It's currently 1 to 17. 3 years ago, when I came on board, it was 1 to 20. We've moved to secure more staff, 27 more staff, to bring that number down from 1 to 20. It was down as low as 1 to 15. It's moved back up to 1 to 17. So it's something, it's critical that we try our best to address this. But I want to, without going into the weeds, very quickly talk about the nature of cases. I mentioned earlier that the number of children in custody had not increased significantly. It's plateaued at approximately 1,000 children. Somebody might wonder, you know, why are the caseload ratios going up? Because we're getting far more calls on the front end that have to be investigated and looked at. Within 72 hours is what the law says, and we have to adhere to that. So we have to sometimes pull our staff off of the regular caseload work, that 1 to 17 ratio work, that working with families, and move them to the investigation front. And that's what's causing the challenge. What we can do about that is that people have to insist that we have the resources necessary to do this very hard work. And they have to say, look, you know, we can have criticisms, and I'm not making excuses for errors in judgment, mine or anyone else's, but you need the tools to do the job, and we need to be open about that. The governor's asked me, as I mentioned, to give him a review of the resources that we need and to do that quickly, and I will work on that, and I am working on that. So the call is an important one. I'm glad it was asked.
Do you think you need more social workers, more caseworkers?
I'm sorry, you broke up at the end. Caseload or
do you think you need? Yeah, do you need more caseworkers? I mean, we're not at the national average, and you've just said that some of them are getting pulled off to tackle calls rather than being on their cases that they're currently working on. So do you need more?
Well, I've said before, and I'll answer your question, that I don't think there's a child welfare administrator in the nation who would say he's got enough resources, and I'm one of them. But I think before just saying we need to reduce caseload ratios, we need to look at what are the special skills that we need in the face of this changing landscape, in the face of an epidemic of opiates and drug abuse. Do we need more nurses? Do we need more staff with substance abuse knowledge to help us screen people and to make the referrals? Do we need more community partners who do family coaching and other efforts? It's a larger question than just social workers. But yes, when your earn ratios are too high, you cannot strike the kind of relationships that you need to do this work. I have not concluded my review, but I think that's an answer.
When you say you're looking into whether we need more nurses or whether we need people with more experience in dealing with drug addiction, why don't you know that already? I mean, isn't that ongoing? Isn't that something that you see as a problem now and you should know whether or not we need more of those types of people?
Well, how many is an open question. I can't tell you exactly how many. We have to look at our caseloads and try to examine that. My job is to try to craft a therapeutic dose that will be meaningful and that will help make the change. And that's not a flip the switch, oh, we need 10 more of these, et cetera. It does take some examination. It's easy to look at the caseload ratio number and say you're at 1 to 17 and you need to move to 1 to 12. But the underlying causes and the assistance, the call, Cliff, who called in with a specific issue with mental health issues, and trying to augment our staff with those kinds of levels of expertise is not necessarily an easy review.
Commissioner Iacovone, when you think philosophically about your job and the job of a Department for Children and Families, it's tragic when there's any case of abuse, and certainly when it results in the death of a toddler. Do you believe that the department should have the aim of getting to the point where you have no abuse in the state of Vermont? Or is this something that we have to be able to live with in some sense because your department is never going to be able to stop this alone?
Well, that's the $64 question, isn't it? It really is. And no matter no matter what we do, there will always be tragedies. I can't control that. You know, the chief of police in your town can't guarantee that everybody's going to be safe, but he tries his hardest. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try our best. And that's what I, if there's anything to benefit from these kinds of tragedies, it's got to be an aggressive review of how we do what we do to improve it, to be open if we need more resources and practice changes. But to answer your question, it's naive of me to think that there will never be any abuse no matter what I do. Sadly, there will be. But it's my responsibility to do the best I can to strengthen our system, policy, practices, resources, to help strengthen families to lessen the likelihood of that.
Dave Iacovone is the commissioner of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
That is going to wrap up today's program. Tomorrow, we're going to move to explore the myths and legends that have grown up around Ethan Allen. John Duffy and Nick Muller are the authors of a new book called Inventing Ethan Allen. They'll discuss how and why the lore of this famous Vermonter was created. You can send your questions about Ethan Allen to vermontedition@vpr.net. You can also continue today's conversation at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.